This is Air Commander Starscream, and you are listening to Half Measures. Half Measures? Sounds like Megatron's battle strategy.
Kia ora and welcome to episode 195 of the Half Measures podcast. I'm once again joined by my friend and co-host, Mr. Porkenauer. How you doing today, pal?
Kia ora, Dan. Kei te pihe koe.
Kei te pai.
Kia ora. My apologies. I forgot what our Deputy Prime Minister told us about asking questions in Te Reo Māori. Are we framing English? How you doing? You're doing good.
I'm doing very good. And this is also an independent podcast that can't be influenced by outside sources, you know?
Correct.
Irrelevant. So what's been happening in life? We're on the countdown to the holiday season. Is your Christmas shopping in hand? Is work winding down?
Work is most certainly not winding down. Those days are gone. I remember days gone by where we would literally, in like the last day of the year and maybe the first day of the year, be playing cards. Like someone would have a deck of cards in the office and we'd play cards. Or I remember once running a bit of an offbeat workshop early in the year when no one was really back in the office and we were sort of mapping out, you know, the Star Wars movies and sort of trying to put things in a timeline order.
I think you're right. Like I don't think anyone really winds down anymore. I think it just stops, and there's so much of like, you know, there's nothing really we'll say at that till next year. It all just blends into one giant cocktail. But Paul, this is our last, you know, regular format episode for the year. Next week we'll be taking a small break for the Christmas period, and then we'll be back with our world famous, shall I say, top 10 TV shows of 2023. So very exciting. So this is sort of probably your last chance to sort of talk about any shows that you want to maybe bring to the table in that space. So I feel like we've got, I don't know about you, I've got lots to talk about. You've probably got lots to talk about. Should we jump on into it?
Yeah, I think we should. I think you're setting us up nicely because we've got part one of the top 10 just after Christmas, late Christmas present for everyone, and then part two of the top 10 first part of the year. So this is our last regular record of the year. So let's jump in because I have got more than normal to talk about this week. So maybe, I don't know, maybe either I talk fast or you put your podcast on at 1.25. I don't know, whatever works best for you. Maybe a bit of both. Shall I jump in?
Take us away, Paul. What have you got for me this week?
So, first up, I have the return. Now, some people been calling this season 13, or some people have been calling this season 1. This is Frasier. For me, I'm regarding it as season 1. The return of Kelsey Grammer as Frasier. Many years after the events of Frasier, following the death of his father, Frasier returns to Boston, which of course is where he started out before he moved to Seattle. He started in Boston, of course, in Cheers, for a college lecture and to check in on his son, who he quickly suspects is keeping a secret from him. And so this is I don't know if it's a one and done or if it's the season one of many. There's no indication anywhere I can find anywhere. It's 10 episodes at this point. There is good and there is bad.
I've got to be honest, I have mostly only heard the bad with this, and I know that you're a big Frasier fan, so I'm looking forward to your thoughts on this one.
So yes, yeah, so Kelsey Grammer, for me, has not lost a beat at all. He's just jumped straight back in, and, you know, this is 30 years since Frasier started, and we're going back, you know, over 40 years for Cheers. It's incredible, really. He doesn't look that much older to me. And when he started in Cheers back in the 80s, he was 29 years old. And that seems impossible to me. When he was in like, he was in his late 30s when Frasier started. And yet he always seemed, I don't know, like late 40s, if not 50 at that point. And so the fact that he's now actually in real life 60, well, not 60s, in his 60s, means that he actually looks as you might expect him to back in the day. It's incredible. His voice is perfect. The delivery of lines is that classic Frasier physical humor, the angry upper class, I'm better than you demeanor hasn't changed a bit. And he is great. There was two cameos from the cast returning as characters from Cheers and Frasier. And I will say right now that those two episodes were, without any shadow of a doubt, the absolute highlights of this series. What comes next, I think, isn't going to convince anyone to watch the show, I don't think. And it's a real shame, but the writing of the show is not at the level of Frasier. It is not at the level of Cheers by a long shot. And we're still, the support cast that he's surrounded by are a really, really mixed bag. Some are okay, some horrific, but none of them are great.
It feels like a shame. I feel like I'm having a real moment of deja vu, and maybe this was while we were talking about Frasier, maybe in the news. But yeah, I'm surprised. Like, I've always thought of him as an older person. So it is funny that he was 29 back when filming that.
Incredible.
And I don't know what it is. There's just something that's never really resonated with me about the show. So, like, it never clicked back then, and I'm not sure, just even flicking through the trailer and the stills now, whether it's for me or not.
No, I would say not. I really wanted this to work, but the problem is, and I've worked this out, and I reckon I should get in contact with the studio in case they do another. The thing is, Frasier needs an adversary. He needs someone to go toe-to-toe with him. In Cheers, he had, you know, the whole buyer of these extraordinary characters played by some of the funniest cast members any TV comedy has ever seen. And then in Frasier, he had Niles. He had his dad. He had Roz. He had characters who could give as good as they got. And it was hilarious, particularly his brother and his dad, I think. You know, the Niles and Frasier back and forth. For me, that was actually my 90s American comedy highlight. It was what made me a Frasier person, probably more than I was a Friends person at that stage in my life. And this new series, there's just no one at all who can keep up with Frasier. And so what you're left with is this one-sided comedy where he's either setting up these great lines or he's knocking down average lines, but you never see much on the other side. It's like a tennis match where only one side of the court is worth watching. It's really odd.
It's funny. I think that's a really astute observation, because I think you're right. Like, when I do think of Frasier, it's a little bit like, and this isn't a show that resonates with me, but I would imagine, you know, Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory. Like, it's kind of that type of vibe. Like, if he's not going up against someone, there's nothing there. That's the humor isn't there. So it seems strange that they would maybe miss this beat or opportunity in a reboot of a show like this.
It is. And my biggest disappointment, because, you know, I haven't mentioned any of the support cast, but my biggest disappointment was Nicholas Lyndhurst, who's opposite him. Yeah, I know. He is someone who I absolutely loved to watch as a child in the 80s. Mm. Yeah, and as a teenager in the 80s. His Only Fools and Horses was just exceptional alongside David Jason. That back and forth is what's missing in Frasier. And Frasier and Nicholas Lyndhurst's character in this just didn't work for so many reasons, but primarily because he's just a really poorly written character. They gave him this ridiculous accent. And honestly, it would have been better to have combined the Frasier universe with the Only Fools and Horses universe and have Frasier and Rodney Trotter be on screen together. I would have preferred that than what I got. And then the even weirder thing with each episode is that as it ended, my hope for the next episode was renewed, because Kelsey Grammer, as he did in Frasier, starts singing the tossed salad and scrambled eggs song, and you hear him singing that. And every time I heard that song as the credits were going and they played at the final scene, it just brought back those memories of the old Frasier. And then that made me want to go and watch another episode. And then when the next one starts, it has the classic Frasier introduction jingle with the black and white cityscape where they've replaced Seattle with Boston. And again, it gets me excited because it feels like, oh yeah, this is Frasier. This one's going to be good. And then by the 5 to 10 minute mark, I've hit all the same problems that I've just talked about. And despite everything, then, if there's another season, I'll be there though. I cannot explain it. Every time a new episode dropped, I knew it was there and I couldn't wait to watch it, even though I knew it was going to be average. And it's like a comfy old jacket. Something about it, just there's still something in there that I will still go back for, even though I will also say I do not recommend this TV show.
I think there's always a place for these types of shows on streaming, right? Like, they don't have to hit a market for everyone, but as long as that kind of core audience can kind of see it through. Look, I think I'm going to take a wide berth around this one, which I guess is a shame. It would have been nice to have a new sort of like comedy to kind of end the year with. But yeah, that's a shame. So this is a Prime Video series, is it?
No, this is available on TVNZ Plus.
Oh, TVNZ, okay.
I thought it was going to be on Prime, but no, it's TVNZ Plus here in New Zealand. If you do fancy a dip into it just as a one-off, go into the episode with his ex-wife, Lilith Returns from Cheers, and it's just like it was, and it's great. That's proof that it could have been special if they just, I don't even know if I could say cast good. Like I said, Nicholas Lyndhurst, you and I both know he's a fantastic actor, just write decent characters for him to go opposite. Anyway, enough Fraser banging. What's the word? Yeah, enough negativity around Fraser. Let's move into something positive, and that is Beckham. This is a 4-part TV miniseries with never-before-seen footage, a docu-series that follows David Beckham's life, his whole rise from his humble beginnings in London all the way to Manchester, to Madrid, to the US and onwards, to global football stardom. And I will say, as someone who grew up in the UK and was watching football before Beckham was around as a player, saw him arrive, watched him his whole career, and have been watching since he left the game, I do feel like I have a certain amount of sort of context to sort of assist me in deciding whether I'd say this was well done or not. And this is absolutely superb. And I would say even without the bigger picture and the context that I have as someone who's watched his career anyway, this documentary still stands up on its own because it just literally spoon feeds you. Sorry, the sort of day by day almost at some point when he's really young, all the way through step by step for his entire life. So it's just a really interesting insight to understand a very successful person's career, the success and everything that comes with it, including all of the lows.
And so did you find you sort of like learned, you know, obviously sort of going on the journey with him, seeing Beckham arrive, did you learn a lot from the documentary, or was it kind of stuff you were kind of familiar with or aware of that was going on in this life? Like, it's certainly getting lots of great reviews out there. It's very much on my watch list to check out.
I definitely did learn a lot because there was so much of his story I knew anyway. And so I saw him, you know, on pitch and pitch side and camera side in terms of what the world saw throughout the 90s and so on. And then what you see is what was happening behind the scenes each step of the way, and him and Victoria Beckham and others, lots of significant others throughout, talk about, you know, what they thought was really going on at the time. It's quite funny. So they'll show an interview with Sir Alex Ferguson live in the 90s, responding to something that Beckham has said or done, and then it will cut to Sir Alex Ferguson today, and he'll contradict himself and just say, "That's absolute rubbish," you know. But he had to say what he said at the time in the front of the media, of course, and then you get the truth. It was I find it just fascinating. It was a real behind the curtain of someone's career, their personal life. It I think it has sort of credibility because it doesn't try and skip past that. You know, there's lots of things in there that are very difficult and hard, like the hard stuff. There are things that not everyone would want brought up in a documentary. So it's very balanced in that respect. And the other thing that really appeals to me is the style in which it's filmed is very compelling. They have Beckham and others frequently close up, seemingly staring at you, the audience, at the camera, but actually he's actually watching the footage from a game of a goal or a tackle, and you're getting this real-time reaction of his face to these old videos. And the face says so much. It's a really effective way of doing it.
It's funny, eh, because I feel like as a fairly newcomer to the football scene, I always sort of feel like the media sort of portrayed David Beckham as not the sort of the smartest guy around. But I feel like over the last, I would say, year, I feel like he's kind of been shown in a whole different light, which I think, and I don't know whether this documentary kind of like speaks to that, or whether it's just a weird perception that we had here, or what it is. But I feel like I've got a different respect for him than I've had previously.
Yeah, no, I mean, my respect for him has gone up even more. He just comes across as this all-round nice guy, very hard not to like, which makes it even harder to understand the way he was treated by some fans during the turbulent times, which I'll never forget. And what's weird is, amongst all the glory and the success and the fame and the football and the celebrity life, the thing that resonated most with me were the casual scenes of the documentary. Him at home right now, and you know, with his family, just living his life in the back garden, playing football with his son, cooking up food on the grill, just the simple things, and seeing how ultimately those things are what really mattered to him all throughout his career. He was always very much family focused, and I think that speaks a lot to him. I think if you're a fan of the Spice Girls, there's something in there for you as well, because you know, you get quite a bit of the Victoria story and all the relevant parts that sort of fit in there as well. But yeah, it's a very, very insightful, very intimate view, and they don't cut the camera at a lot of times where I think they would have cut a camera in a documentary. You know, when you can see someone sort of turning, looks like they're going to break down, they just follow the camera a bit longer. And some of the really, really fun parts, and again, credit to the producers, was where things would happen during an interview that would normally be cut for sure, and they've decided to keep it in because that in itself tells a story of his relationship, and it's really nice. And so there's this moment where Victoria Beckham's being interviewed, and she says, oh, you know, I grew up working class. And David clearly hears that and so just pokes his head through a door, and he goes, tell the truth. And she goes, I am telling the truth. He said, tell the truth. What car did your dad drive? And she's trying several times to dodge the question. And eventually she says, okay, so he drove a Rolls Royce. And he goes, yeah. And then he just shuts the door. And it's like, you could tell from her reaction, there's no way that was staged. And it's a really, really lovely, lovely, lovely watch. And I think there's a few things in it that I kind of tuned out a bit when it got to like Milan and Paris and parts of the US stuff, but it's very, very compelling watch.
I'm going to add it to my watch list. I've got a flight coming up over the holiday period. This could be perfect flight viewing.
Perfect. Four hours. So yeah, four episodes, Netflix, four episodes. I would say even if you did the first two, you'd get a hell of a lot out of it.
Nice. Very good.
Right. Cracking on. There's so much to get through. I've still got two more things to go, Dan. People can be sick of hearing my voice. So bloody let's greedy, rock on.
I tell you.
The Dark Knight Rises. So finish the trilogy of these three exceptional Batman movies. This is 2012. It was filmed 4 years after The Dark Knight, set 8 years after the Joker's Reign of Chaos, where he comes up against the vicious terrorist Bane, and sort of is coerced out of exile with the assistance of the mysterious Selina Kyle, aka Catwoman. And having watched this movie, I think one of the hardest questions to answer right now would be if someone says to me, oh yeah, what's the best Batman movie? Because as we discussed when we did our special podcast, our 1989 Batman, that for me is just top tier. And like you, last year we watched the Robert Pattinson Batman. Absolutely incredible. The Dark Knight Rises in isolation maybe is not quite number one, but when you watch it back to back like I have over the last 3 weeks with the other two in this trilogy, the emotional connection to the character going into this movie is so high at the end of the last movie. It always gets me. This is such a fascinating, it's such a superb rewatch. It really is.
It's funny, I think, just all our talk about, I guess, Batman, talking about like 4K and Blu-rays, and I just sort of, I've noticed in some junk mail that we actually had recently, like, you know, the Dark Knight collection on 4K, and I thought, this would be a fantastic series to kind of get back into the fixed media, because this is a series you 100% I think want to watch back to back. One that, as you have said numerous times now, this movie is 11 years old, still standing the test of time. But I guess my question for you, Paul, is, do you think darkness is your ally?
That line I love that line. And in some ways, you've ruined this movie for me, because every time I hear that line, I think of you. It's like when I watch A New Hope, sometimes I think of the Family Guy lines from A New Hope. It's like, it's so synonymous. It is superb. What Tom Hardy does in that scene, I mean, his voice throughout this movie it's a show stealer for me. It's so unique. It's so distinctive. It's always a joy to rewatch him replay all those lines and all those scenes. He's such a different interpretation of any Bane I ever understood. And yeah, as soon as that scene comes up, it's a special moment, because we know what's happening. We go into the recreation of the breaking of the bat from the comic, which of course is one of the best-selling comics of all time. It's the other thing is, this movie, for my money, has the best entrance of any Batman to any Batman movie. In fact, I would say the best superhero entrance I've ever seen. It may be the best character entrance ever. I don't know, but there's this 67 second scene, and I know it's that because I found it on YouTube, that is pristine, immaculate perfection. And that's three words that by themselves probably individually is enough. So all three together, you know what I'm saying? It's just, I think what it is that we are nearly 1 hour into a Batman movie and there has been no Batman. And then the lights go out in this motorway underground. You get a glimpse of this black object speeding past. The older cop turns to the younger cop and says, "Oh, you're in for a show tonight." And then the Hans Zimmer theme, which you also haven't heard for the whole hour, kicks in. And then the bat comes in on this awesome motorbike thing. It gets me every time, Dan, and I'll never forget seeing it in the cinema. It's absolutely pristine.
You're giving me the goosies, and you sent me the link for that.
I couldn't help myself
as well. And it's you're right. It's so incredible and so well done. And just thinking about, you're Christopher Nolan. You're pitching this to the studio execs. You're like, look, I want to do, a Batman where, like, he's a new Batman. He's, we'll do a bit of an origin story, and then we'll do one where he's kind of comfortable being the Bat, and then we'll do one where he's kind of at the end of his career. Like, what an arc! Like, and I would be happy if with like the Patterson Batman, we kind of repeated that formula just with its own tale, it's a perfect model. Like, don't mess with it. Like, give us three, but give us three quality ones. And I think that was something that was always interesting to me about, I guess, Batfleck is, I feel like I'm really intrigued in the older Batman, and I just love that in The Dark Knight, they kind of toy with the whole kind of Nightwing, Robin type, yes. The handing over of the mantle.
That's it.
But I love that they don't ever like, look, we're giving you some little nods here, but we're not giving you the full, like, this is not what we're about. This is a three movie trilogy, and I respect them for those choices.
I still haven't ruled out, since you've gone there, I still haven't ruled out the possibility that Nolan might return one day if he gets given the rights to bring Joseph Gordon-Levitt back, and have him pick up where he left off in this movie. Because of course we know him in this movie as John Blake, and then at the end he's like, oh, that's just a nickname. My actual name's Robin, and he's got the keys to the castle, or keys to the Batcave at least. His character was very interesting in this movie. I think the way you described it there with Christopher Nolan's vision, that's what works and makes this trilogy superb. We've often talked about it, and I won't go at it at length, but the sequel Star Wars trilogy, where we go from J.J. Abrams to Rian Johnson and then back to someone else to J.J. Abrams, it's not a vision. It's not a complete picture. And this is someone who mapped it out from start to finish, and may have gone in a different direction a long way, but kept his own signature across all three. And it just tells so much.
This is great. This has been a great rewatch. I kind of wish I was on the journey with you, actually. You kind of gave me the option early on, and you shone the bat symbol into the sky.
I did.
I didn't respond.
I put the symbol up and I was waiting, but there was nothing. So I may have to check the batteries on the torch. But my last remark would be, because I think I really think she deserves mention, is Anne Hathaway in this as Selina Kyle. I think she's very, very good in this. I think in a very understated way, I think this role that she has, as Selina Kyle, as Catwoman, but mainly as Selina Kyle, I prefer that lens across that character. I think it's more interesting. But I do feel like we don't get enough time to explore her story. And I would argue, for comparison's sake, that we get more about Selina Kyle in Batman Returns, which is, you know, like a 2-hour movie, than we do in this movie, which goes for nearly 3 hours, which is a real shame. And despite all the positives I've said, I will also say I still think this movie is a little long. I still think we could have cut a little, but maybe I'm just getting old. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Look, this is good. I love that it's good. So give me your rough ranking, Paul, of these movies if you had to rank them, even though it's almost impossible.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, I feel like 3-2-1, but I know that's just because of how much I've enjoyed 3, and I need to walk away and come back, and it's probably going to revert back to 2-3-1. But I remember when I watched the first Batman Begins, and I said to you, how can the other two be better than this one? That's how much I love 1 as well. So 1 comes in last, but it's still absolutely exceptional.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I might have to rewatch it. I'm adding it to my list as we speak.
Big screen, phone off the hook in the dark. It's just exceptional. Right, my last thing before I hand the keys to you, Dan, is the third Doctor Who 60th anniversary special, and that is the giggle. And I will try not to talk too many spoilers, but if you are thinking of watching it, do flick forward 3 or 4 minutes till you hear Dan talking about his stuff. I would say of these three specials, this is probably my pick of the bunch. I think they do things in this that have never been done before, and that may sound pretty easy to say, but when you watch it, you get it. If you've watched enough Doctor Who, this is distinctly different, and they go in a different path for the Doctor. A number of things quite noteworthy. Another one is a returning villain. So we've always had that in Doctor Who. That's been a big thing. If you think about the number of times we've had the Daleks or the Cybermen or the Master, but this episode marks the return of a character called the Celestial Toymaker. It's the first time we've had him show up in 57 years. So he first turned up opposite the original Doctor all the way back in 1966. Fun fact, the Toymaker was played in 1966 in that Doctor Who by Michael Gough, who played Alfred in all 4 of the Tim Burton Batman movies. So Michael Gough played him. The Toymaker in this special is played by Neil Patrick Harris. And Neil Patrick Harris is someone who people have said, oh, Doogie Howser, oh, How I Met Your Mother. I've never really watched any of those things. So for me, I don't have that. But he is absolutely sensational, I think, as this character, the Toymaker in the special. And he challenges the Doctor in a way that not many adversaries do. It was really, really well written, well produced, very, very enjoyable. And I'm just trying to find, I can't do two things at once, the rankings, how it ranks up against the other two specials. But for my money, it's the pick of the three.
Yeah, what are we looking at, about an 8.5 on this one? It's not too bad out of 10. It looks like I've heard a few people say this has been their favourite so far. Unfortunately, have dropped the Doctor Who ball and dropped off at the first episode.
So the one we watched, the Star Beast, that's now sitting at 7.1 out of 10. This one's 8.5 out of 10. I would say that's a fair reflection of where I think this series has gone. He takes over the planet, essentially, with this mysterious puppet driving the human race insane, and the Doctor finds a way to overcome this challenge, but at the, you know, jumping into spoilers, as I said, it would at the, not the expense of his life, but at the forced introduction of our 15th Doctor. So I'd said to you, I think they'll wait until we get to the
Christmas.
Yeah, so the Christmas one. But this one, we have Shuti Gatwa debuting as the 15th Doctor. Quite an entrance for him, but done in a very different way, whereby instead of regenerating, which is what has happened since the very start, David Tennant survives this process and bi-generates. And we have two doctors, David Tennant and Shuti Gatwa.
You've heard it here first, folks. This is a Doctor Who
spoilers.
spoiler. So does that mean, does it end with still two Doctors, or does it get tidied up somewhere in the multiverse?
We still have two Doctors right now as we speak. My instinct is obviously we'll be following the 15th Doctor, but in this universe that we live in this Hooniverse, if you will, the 14th Doctor, David Tennant's Doctor, is still out there. And so who knows when we might bump into him, or if we might, you know, switch streams and go and check out what's going on with him. It's a very, very unprecedented. It would be like if we were in the 80s, it would be like Tom Baker carrying on and Peter Davison carrying on.
Outrageous. And what about Catherine Tate? Is she still banging around as well, or has her arc finished?
No, that's where the 14th Doctor is. He's gone back to her place, essentially, with the family. When we leave them, they're all having dinner together. And no, very, very interesting. It's a fun little factor as well. This is quite nice. David Tennant has said many times that, you know, Doctor Who was why he got into acting. And the 15th Doctor, Shuti Gatwa, as it's pronounced, his name, he said multiple times that David Tennant is one of the main reasons he wanted to become an actor. And so in this episode, we have someone who is acting alongside another person who made him want to become an actor, who's playing the role that made him want to become an actor. It's just fun. It's really fun. And it's just a really, really, really good story. It's a longer one than the other two as well. And it warrants that extra time. Very satisfying story. Lots of emotions along the way. And yeah, looking forward now to the Christmas special, which drops in New Zealand Boxing Day, but Christmas Day in Europe.
Amazing. That was going to be my next question. Does it actually drop on Christmas Day, or is it just a one-hour special, or is it like sort of a movie-length
event? That I'm going to have to pass on. I don't know. I only know it will be Christmas Day and Boxing Day morning for us, which is kind of cool because I'm not always around a television set Christmas Day evening, so that way I get to watch it live on Boxing Day morning, where I'm probably not up to too much. So yeah, that's Disney Plus for these Doctor Who specials.
Very good. Well, we're that brings us to the end of another episode of the Half Measures podcast.
So sorry, 32 minutes in, that has got to be an absolute record. I'm sorry, but I had to. I just, you know, busy at work. Busy on the old TV box, so
busy life.
What have you been watching, Dan?
All right, I've got three things for you as well. So I'll be fast on the first one. So, my father-in-law owes me 1 hour and 32 minutes back of my life, because the other day he was like, round of this house, have you guys heard about this new movie Ballerina? Never heard of it. And he's like, it looks really good. So we go home. We have a look. This is a Korean action thriller, I guess. And to be honest with you, didn't look like a normal genre of movies. Watched the trailer and we thought, you know what? We haven't got much going on. Let's put it on. I think we made a mistake, Paul. So, well, we made two mistakes. Actually, probably made about three. First, I don't know why we took on this recommendation. He's got in my spreadsheet where I keep track of who recommends what to me, he's got a shoddy review count. Anyway, we watched the movie. We decided we'll watch it like you should with any foreign film. We'll watch it with subtitles. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, something happened. Like, we didn't, I'm really telling you everything about the movie. We ordered some dinner and we're like, actually, let's just put it to, you know, an English dub and we'll come back to it. And it was at that point where we really just struggled to maintain any interest. So the basic kind of premise here is our main character is, we don't know much about her. She's a bodyguard, almost sort of a little bit kind of John Wick like. Her best friend dies, somehow manages to leave her a note that says "get revenge," and that is pretty much the plot of the movie. She goes about getting revenge. It's got some pretty decent fight scenes, I would say. Story wise, it's paper thin, Paul. This is If we were doing a movie of the week, this would be a one gun for me, unfortunately.
Oh, no.
Which is a bit of a shame. I don't know why my father-in-law was so hyped for this movie and why he's out there. I think he's been paid by somebody to promote it because I've never seen any promotion about this movie. But here we have it, The Ballerina. Don't get it confused with a 2024 movie coming out in the John Wick universe around Ballerina. This is something quite different. Yeah, hard pass. That's any questions before I take us on to the next adventure in my life?
Not really. I mean, I was just, as I always like to do, I was like to say, oh, have I seen the director or writer before? No. Any of the stars? No. All I will say is it's still sitting at a 6.2 out of 10, which isn't bad. We've watched some things, you know, I always think of Bill and Ted 3 as the classic go-to where the world appears to agree with us. This still picks up. So what my question to you actually is, thinking about last week, how does this sit next to Xmas and 65? Where does it sit in amongst those two?
I think there's some criteria for watching a film like this. So one, I think watch it with subtitles and in Korean. It's far better. As soon as we switched to English, We virtually just like, it was instant. We kind of like lost interest in it because the dub is never good on these types of movies. As I said, the action's kind of good, but it's just kind of a paper-thin story with not a lot of depth. But I think if you're looking for that sort of John Wick type thing, I guess like John Wick's pretty paper-thin as well, so it's not terrible. I think it was actually made worse because it was hyped up to me, and then I had it didn't deliver. I think if no one had hyped it up to me and I just put it on, I might have kind of just made my own calls and been like, oh, yeah, that was all right for what it was. But once the hype man had been involved, not sure.
One to watch on Netflix for all our listeners by the sounds of it.
Indeed. The next thing on my list, Paul, this is a recommendation from you that we've jumped on. This is season one of The Morning Show.
Yes.
So we decided we'd give this a go. And it was interesting. Now, we've been on an interesting journey with The Morning Show. So we kind of put it on, watched the first couple of episodes. It was interesting, but I wasn't sure I was hooked. But I had this experience where, you know, 10 episodes like maybe one to sort of three, I was kind of like, oh, I don't know if it's for me. Is this for me? By episode 10, I was in so deep. I was like, I was having Succession level of like, can't wait for the next episode. And I was having such a great time. And I think I was almost comparing it to like a Succession type thing at the start where I wasn't resonating with all of the sort of secondary characters, and it wasn't kind of drawing me in. But by the time we got to the end, I was well and truly drawn in. And not to kind of, you know, you've already reviewed this show, so I don't need to go too deep on it.
What's exciting about this, Dan, is that now we can watch season two and three. If we time ourselves right, if we get our calendars sorted and talk to our EAs, we can get this, we can do joint reviews.
Get it on your holiday calendar. I reckon we're going to probably stroll straight on into it. So
beautiful.
That could be good. So I think I remember something you saying to me, and this really stood out for me. So I have never seen Steve Carell in a role like this. Like he's Michael Scott for me, and I really hope that this hasn't damaged my perception of Michael Scott, because he is a character like you just, I'm just not used to seeing him like this. And I think, again, just to sort of, you know, you've said this, but I think what's so fascinating about The Morning Show is it really kind of just gets you thinking and questioning and kind of wondering about, like, they sort of deal with sexual harassment and some pretty dark topics, which have some pretty dark outcomes. And just the whole sort of notion of, are you complicit in these things, even though, like, if you know about it, then don't do anything. And I think, you know, you've got to give it to Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon. Like, those two absolutely, like, smash this out of the park. And I think, particularly Jennifer Aniston, like, I know she's done a lot of things, but I feel like this is a real powerhouse role for her. And same with Reese Witherspoon, but again, like, she's a big dog. We just had a lot of fun. It really grew on us. we're definitely going to jump straight into season two. I wish I'd been more organized so that I could have had maybe season three as a potential contender for anything top 10. But unfortunately, a little bit behind on that. But yeah, this is a great show. And the fact that it's been out since 2019, it's madness, like why I haven't watched it so far.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad because we still haven't got into season two and we keep wanting to, but there's so many things we want to watch, especially the 2023 content to make sure I've got as many options as possible for the top 10. So definitely going to jump into season two of The Morning Show, or The Morning Wars, as it's known in Australia, don't forget. But yeah, you're so right. The Steve Carell, that for me, his character is the most terrifying for me in the show, that privileged ignorance that he has. He's so far removed from reality that he's either lying or he's just convinced himself that what he's doing isn't wrong, and he's just how can there be any other truth than what I'm telling? And it's terrifying. It's really powerful. And I think you're right, Jennifer Aniston, I remember saying to you at the time, because we've already done a peak performance for her, that for me, I would have to throw this into the mix. And Reese Witherspoon, honestly, there's nothing I've seen of her that's even, like, for me, this really raised her profile for me. I think she's quite exceptional in this, and the two of them together were just fantastic.
There's some really other great characters in the show as well. Like, I really enjoyed Mark Duplass, who plays Chip Black, and like just the pressure to be the producer on a morning show, and just the way, that type of job works, where you're just like, you're 24/7, there's no real breaks, you're dealing with everything major that's happening. I think he plays a wonderful role, both as a friend and advocate, and just also trying to get a bit involved in the politics, a bit out of his head. But there's a character in there which weirdly, like, I kind of thought was going to end badly, but he became one of my favorite characters in season one, Corey Ellison, who...
Yeah, that's the guy.
Like, he really has a kind of a real slimy type of... it's something that doesn't sit well, but there's something about his character and his smile and his sense of humor and his banter that makes him kind of a highly enjoyable character.
And I think there's a part of him that's a good guy as well. And he's constantly smiling at moments where chief executives or owners of companies surely wouldn't be smiling or comfortable with the way things are unfolding. But he's like, let it rip. Let's see where this goes. And he's got Billy Crudup is fantastic. When I think of him, I really only think of his performance in Alien Covenant on board the ship. That's my go-to for him. But he is fascinating. Nestor Carbonell, the Yanko, the weather guy. Perfect. Of course, I just saw him show up in The Dark Knight Rises. So that made me think of this show even then. So many good characters. It feels, and I know we say this a lot about Apple TV productions in terms of the quality, but it feels like it would make, what am I trying to say here? I would love to know, even if we think about here in New Zealand, TVNZ or the BBC or whatever, when they sort of cut and they go to commercials, what's actually happening? What actually is the vibe? Because they present this, this wonderful atmosphere of a joined up team, all smiles, but actually behind the scenes, not only are they at each other's throats, but they were literally only 2 seconds before they called action. And I'd love to see in real life how it wouldn't be as dramatic as this, of course, and I wouldn't want it to be, but I'd love to know.
It's interesting too. Like, I think when I first started watching the show, what I almost wanted is what they actually gave to me near the end of the show. So, so it kind of starts off, the whole morning show is obviously kind of disrupted with, the exiting of Steve Carell's character. And I was saying to Samara, I'm like, I actually wish we had a couple of episodes of him just being who he was, so that I could get a sense of like what the big deal of breaking up this co-host situation would be. But when we finally got that episode where they kind of do that flashback in time, I think it might have been about episode 8 or something. It was so good because I kind of had all the hatred and the frustration, and then kind of to see the way that it kind of played out from other people's perspectives when Steve Carell's character was acting the way he was, it kind of meant so much more. So look, and again, like you said this, it's hard to think that a show about the news would be that interesting. But I often found myself being like, I actually wish they played the news clip that kind of went alongside with this, because I was so hooked into the story and what they were talking about. It was, this was a real delight and a great recommendation. So you, my friend, will be getting bonus points on my spreadsheet, unlike my father-in-law, who is in the negatives.
I feel like there's been a few this year. There's been The Lazarus Project. There's been Welcome to Wrexham Season 1, which you came on board with. There was something else in there, the morning show. So I feel like there's been some hits there. And of course, you've given me Ozark and Succession. So this is good. But this show does, the other thing I didn't mention, which I think you've touched on, is that it really brings to the surface that, and I know there was a lot of criticisms of people saying that it was trying too hard to push an agenda, but it really brings to that, you know, that dark story of the abuse of power and the, on a scale that I've never seen on a TV show before. And I think it's, there was a little bit of that in Bombshell, the movie we watched with Charlize Theron and Nicole Kidman. I can't wait to get into season 2. We'll have to, see if we can line that up as a potential watch of the week early doors next year.
That sounds good. And I think that's almost like, you know, I mentioned Succession at the start of this. It's like, you know, you see the role that the Waystar Corporation has on media, and, you know, you can control who is going to be, you know, on camera, what stories run. And the morning show is no different, right? Like, it's just so fascinating to be like, hey, look, we've got these 3 stories. What do you want to cover? And you're kind of thinking about actually, for our listeners, this is what's going to actually track better. And it's just, it's about everything but the actual news half the time. And it kind of, I think, just spotlights some things, which I think we can often, which you can sort of sometimes be a bit naive about. So, yeah, this is a great show, highly recommended. We'll definitely be going into season 2. Looking forward to talking about it more next year.
Awesome.
All right, Paul, I've got one more show for you. So, we're 46 minutes in. This is the longest what have you been watching segment we've ever had, I think. So this is a TV show on Netflix, and it is called Blue Eye Samurai. It is an animated TV show and 8 episodes. It's in the news desk today. It's just been renewed for season 2, even though IMDb calls it a miniseries. This is one of the greatest TV shows I've seen this year, Paul. This is definitely going to be in my top 10. Haven't quite decided where it's going to sit yet. It completely took me by surprise. It is both wonderful storytelling, just fantastic animation, soundtrack, direction, interesting story. It's dark. It can be a little bit violent. It's basically about it's a story of revenge. It's sort of set in the Edo period in Japan, which is sort of in the 1600s, the 1800s, about a young Japanese warrior, and she's basically born of sort of mixed race. So she's white / Japanese, and she this is sort of early spoilers, but portrays herself as a man because a woman couldn't be a samurai. And it's just her tale of revenge, and it is so well done. It's better than so many movies I have sort of seen in this genre. I can't recommend it enough. The supporting cast is great. The voice acting, absolutely incredible. I've been recommending this show to a few people. A lot of people are kind of turning their nose up because it is animated. And I think when people think animated, they think anime. This is more animated, almost like this isn't quite right either, but it feels like a Disney movie. But it's like, this is an R18, R16 sort of series where, like, there's just so much character depth. You feel for the characters. There's something they're able to do through animation which you can't do in real life. And this has definitely just been such a surprise and delight to discover, and I've been hooked from the moment I played the first episode.
Amazing. I was just letting the trailer play as you were talking, and you're right. It doesn't have an anime feel at all. Also, written by the team that wrote Logan, probably my favorite X-Men movie, Blade Runner 2049. And look at that cast, George Takei, Masioka from Heroes, Karihiyoku Tagawa, who played the trade union guy from Men in the High Castle, Kenneth Branagh. It looks fantastic. It sounds fantastic. It's rating fantastic. Funny thing is, Dan, I saw the poster for this and I never sent it to you, but I remember seeing it at the time and I just thought this has got DWK written all over it.
I think it does too. And I think, you know, one of my favorite actual PlayStation games of all time is Ghost of Tsushima. And I absolutely love that kind of the samurai's sort of stories. I'm really looking forward to a TV series coming out early next year called Shogun. But this, if you have any interest in sort of Japanese culture, particularly in that sort of like samurai swordsmith type, this is so good. And I think, I guess my advice to you would be like, don't be put off by that animation. I actually think it absolutely enhances it. And I don't think like that they are wild with this series. I don't want to give too much of it away, but you know, our main character, Mitsu, is, you know, she goes on a perilous mission. She gets knocked back every step of the way and she picks herself back up and sort of carries on the fight. And it's honestly such a good show. I think it's just for a lot of people getting past the animation factor. So I'm very pleased that it's been renewed for a second season. I was a bit worried that this might be a little bit niche, but the fact they're going to do another season, fantastic news.
It's had a lot of votes. You know, when people vote, we spend a lot of time on IMDb, you and I, and so we get a sense of how many people have voted for something. This has had a lot of watches, and those ratings are high, so that's a real good sign.
And look, this is definitely, like, when they drop season two, I'll be straight back for a rewatch. This is that type of show. This is the type of show I would probably own on some sort of media, because I feel like it's going to be great for many years to come. This is all 8 episodes of season 1 are available on Netflix at the moment.
Brilliant.
Paul, shall we? We're so deep into this podcast, I've completely forgotten the order of what we're doing. I guess we're jumping into our watch of the week.
Yeah, we'd normally be getting ready to wrap up by now, but we've still got a ways to go. Keep an eye on that clock, because we could be in for episode 195 being the longest yet. So let's see how we go. So it's time for our watch of the week, where Dan and I bring in either a TV series or a movie to watch and review together. We announce what that will be over in our Discord community, where we now have a calendar of what's coming up in the next few weeks. So if you're keen to see what's coming up, just click on the link in the show notes. And this week, Dan and I are heading back to the Racecourse Stadium in Wales for season 2 of Welcome to Wrexham.
We are indeed. So this is... we've been probably a little bit slow to this one. It has been out for a little while, but it has been fantastic to kind of get back involved with Wrexham, the whole community, the team, Ryan Reynolds, Rob McElhinney. Like it's a bit of a funny one, the show, because I feel like on the first season, I was kind of really like hooked in from episode 1, and I really loved how much of it was actually about the town and the community. And I think season 2 is also about those things, but I also feel like the stakes feel so much higher in season 2. I feel like Wrexham is on my radar a lot more, so I felt like there was kind of like less like genuine surprises. I felt like in season 1 I was literally on the edge of my seat waiting to see what was going to happen with some of these games. In season 2, not so much. I also felt like season 2, and I don't know whether this is true or not, but I feel like it features far more Rob and Ryan compared to the first season. Like I sort of felt like they really stepped up their presence in this. And I don't know, is that a weird bias I have, or did you feel that, Paul?
Don't know that I noticed more Ryan and Rob necessarily. I think I definitely agree with you with the stakes are higher because now the money that they've invested is higher and they've got more things on the line. And that promotion, if it doesn't happen, I think the closing balance sheet they were showing would they would have a loss of 28 million or something. Yeah, something like we're talking proper money, right? But I don't recall feeling like there was more Rob or Ryan. There was definitely some different tangents in this second season, which I really, really loved that we didn't get in the first season because we always get more history of the town, different facets of life. But there was the women's team that we follow for a good solid couple of episodes, which I found very, very interesting. To repeat this from last year, you do not need to be a football fan to love the show because for me, if you were to knit together all of the football clips, I reckon you'd be talking 20% of this series is football, 25% max.
Yeah, look, I agree. I think this is, if you ever had just I think this is the show for people that don't even like sports. Like this was my entry, into this. Like I had zero interest in this, and this kind of sparked a football interest that gave me an understanding of sports like I've never had before, and it kind of just felt like you were back around old friends in the second season, particularly because like they haven't dropped any of the regulars from season one. Like they've got their hardcore supporters, they've got the guy that owns the bar, the lifelong fans. And I think if I kind of package this up with watching Ted Lasso as well, like it makes Ted Lasso feel even more real when you're watching a show like Wrexham because they've got all the elements kind of captured so perfectly.
I love how you've described them as friends because that's how it felt. That's how it felt coming back to this community. You know, nearly a year actually after watching season one. Did leave it late in the year to watch it, but it is a series about community. It's a community about people, their lives, you know, as you say, the pub owner, the groundsman, whoever it is. And with all due respect, because, you know, as we've said, these people have become our friends. And I feel like if I went to Wrexham and I saw Sean or Humphrey or Wayne or Jackie or any of them, I would just be able to say hi. But I have to say, these people that it's about in this community, a lot of them are down on their luck. A lot of them are not having the best of times. And we've got people, and I think it's, you know, the number of people, whether it's directly players or players, partners or families who are having family issues and, you know, loss and having that, you know, people leave or overcoming prejudices, they shy away from nothing. And then the whole thing gets tied together by the football club. It does, the way I've described it there maybe sounds a little bit too romantic, but it feels so authentic to me. It feels so real. Like when you see in this second season, the number of international visitors who've come to visit, just like I've described, I would like to do, because they've seen season one and they want to go in and feel that, and they get there and they do feel that. That's as real as it gets, I think.
I think too, like it's such a, like it's fantastic, like from sort of where to go, right? Like kind of like buying a team that's kind of like low in the leagues, taking us on a journey, breathing fresh life and money, for lack of a better word, into a town which kind of feels a bit like it, you know, that Wrexham as a town is like, you know, it's steeped in kind of like history and disaster, and you know, football is something that they all kind of rally around. And I think I would imagine that the tourism numbers for Wrexham are through the roof. Like it would be insane.
I would say they would be as well, and I think that will just continue the more and more they go on. I've made a genuine effort to avoid not only the results of Wrexham, but the entire league, knowing that this season was coming. And that, you know, as good as it will be watching, even if I did know the results, there's no substitute for not knowing. And for me, it was worth it because I watched every single, you know, every clip of each game as if I was watching it live for the first time. But yeah, the number of people is just going to continue because, you know, I guess we are talking spoilers a bit with the way the league goes this season. I think their profile is just going to rise even further. I'm avoiding their results as, you know, as we speak in this current season. I'm avoiding their results. But I do want to reiterate my favorite story this season, which kind of caught me off guard because it was actually about the women's team. And I found that there was a couple of episodes just on their journey, which And this opinion was actually shared in our Discord chat a couple of weeks ago, and I have to completely agree. I would watch a spin-off of their journey too, 100%. I just found them so down to earth, you know, these everyday life stories of these people in their day jobs, you know, the one player, the winger who's working, you know, washing dishes in that restaurant for 4 hours, and then she goes and plays the game, and you know, she was out at the race course with 9,500 people cheering her on. I found it just absolutely, it's a real emotional watch for me. It's there's no substitute for the kind of emotion that I get watching this. That, you know, you can be watching something that's real when you feel like you're part of something that's bigger than yourselves. It is that whole community feel, that success feel. It's kind of like what I was talking about with Beckham in terms of that sort of the feeling of a footballer's journey, but it's so much bigger than that. And the people in the crowd, the management team, the owners, the players, the families, all of them together, there's no other way than saying it's magnetic, it's a palpable, it's so inspiring that I would have to say I've become a Wrexham fan.
I think you're right. Like, I think the Ghouls team is, I think it just added a whole nother element and realness to the whole club in the sort of the storytelling. So, yeah, I think that was fantastic. I'm with you. That would make a fantastic spin-off. I think one of the things which I also found interesting is, like, now as a club, they're also attracting some pretty, like, top talent and people that are kind of willing to play for them and not worry about what my contract's worth. They want to get the club, you know, back in the right league. They want to support the club. They want to be part of sort of a winning story. And I think what's kind of interesting with that with the series is, like, that's great, but I also feel for some of the players that have to then get sidelined because of that. But I guess that's just sport, right? Like, you want to have the best possible team that you can. And that sometimes means having to stand down people that have got you to where you are today.
Yeah, and that's hard to watch. And it was, and I like how they didn't shy away from that. And the players who were stood down and the ones coming in to take their place didn't shy away from interviews to talk about what that experience was like, because that is the reality of football at any level. And this is where I wonder, you know, what are they thinking off camera? Do they give a slightly different perspective? You know, the goalkeeper who got dropped for, you know, for Ben Foster returning out of retirement. I wonder, and I get that, but it seemed legit when they're together. They seem just to be united as one. And yeah, and you know, in amongst all of this, of course, as you said, there is a lot of Ryan, there is a lot of Rob, and they are hilarious. Always the off-camera looks and the comments, just so good. The cameo, you know, Will Ferrell, Charlie Day, and a few others. They are now so genuinely emotionally invested. I like, it's like two worlds of mine, the world of football and the world of, you know, movies and TV coming together to see Ryan Reynolds so pent up with emotion and anxiety and stress watching a football game, just like I have been as an England fan watching England for years. Yeah, I get that stress watching them get into that, and then to go walking around the town or go into the dressing room to see the players. It's so heartwarming. This show will break any person who doesn't display their emotions when watching telly. It's so fundamentally human. It's wonderful.
I think that's the thing, eh? Like, it just feels so real, and it's such a great, wholesome TV show that it just kind of, it hits you on so many different levels. It feels real human. I guess my question, Paul, is there anything of the show that you didn't like? Like, obviously, this season, a little bit shorter. What are we down at, 15 episodes versus, was it 18 for the first season? Or have I got that around the other way? Anything, like, cause one of the things for me is I sort of think in that final episode, well, they kind of did that annoying documentary thing where it's like, you know, you're in that final game and they keep cutting out to these kind of like moments with, you know, family or supporters or anything. And I was always like, oh, get me back in the game. Like, because like you say, like, it's a short, you know, we're talking 20, 30 minute episodes half the time. And so you want to be sort of part of that journey. And I kind of felt like they're always kind of playing with us, because they're like, oh, meanwhile at the hospital or whatever. Yeah. And it kind of works, I think, for the storytelling. And I think it does speak to what the kind of the wider purpose about the show is. But I always wanted to get back on the pitch, which is something I never would have thought. I would say
Dan saying, I can't wait to get back on the pitch. Get out there, boys, and let's get the job done. I love what you've described is so true, but I love it. It's weird because, you know, we talked about it with movies where they cut from one scene that we're really enjoying to another scene that we don't want to. We're like, get back to the main action. With this, they cut from a wave after a massive game, massive adrenaline, and you're all pumped up for the final game, and then they cut to a family. But what actually happens is at the end of each episode, whether it's football or family or community or suffering or whatever the episode sort of focuses on, like the Wrexham mining disaster, by the time I get to the end of that episode, I'm so invested in that part of the story that when it goes back to the football, I'm like, no, I don't want to watch the game yet. I want to keep going. Mm-hmm. I want to see. I'm really sorry, I've forgotten her name. The young girl with the headphones that watches it. Her story was just absolutely heartbreaking and wonderful at the same time. And you know, I could have watched five more episodes about her. I could have watched five more episodes about the guy with the wife and the issues with pregnancy and just things that all the reasons I came into the show have gone out the window. Each episode I get drawn into, and just like I said, as we talked about in Discord, I could watch a whole 10 episodes of the women's team. I don't want to break away from that team, but then we come back to the main team and I'm like, oh yeah, this is great. Let's keep going with that. So I know what you're saying, but each time they jump, I'm just going with it. It's like someone who's got the remote control keeps changing channel. And I'm enjoying every channel. It's weird.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad too that we kind of ended with we'll be back for a third season, because I think there's so many more stories to tell. And I there's a humbleness to this TV show that I think just kind of works. And like, if you haven't watched any of Wrexham, you're in for a treat. You've got almost 30 episodes, more than 30 episodes of a great TV show.
Yeah, you really have. Disney Plus. Welcome to Wrexham, and don't be put off by the 18 episode season one and 15 episode season two, because some of these episodes, Dan, you know, you're sort of talking 20 minutes, 23 minutes, some 30. There's never anything, I don't think, over really 40 minutes. So it goes past pretty quick.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I think, you know, like shows like this, you know, that like you're talking about Beckham before, it makes it an easy segue to go from this to Beckham to Ted Lasso. There's
such a great week for me. Watching actual live Premier League football, Champions League football, Beckham and Welcome to Wrexham. It was football fuel for me.
Nice. All right, Paul, this is the tough decision. What is your pick of the week?
It is really tough this week. Some great contenders. But yeah, to be honest, as much as I loved, Beckham, as much as I love Doctor Who and The Dark Knight Rises, I still cannot go past Welcome to Wrexham season two for me. It's really good. And I will say right now, if this makes it into my top 10 in our next podcast, I am saying right now that this is not recency bias. This is legitimately that good. And I will go on record to say that season one of the show was also in my top 10 last year. So don't be surprised. Watch this space. What about you, Dan?
I think for me, it's also a tough week. Like, it could have been The Morning Show. It could have been Wrexham. But I think it's going to be The Blue Eye Samurai. Because I think for me, like, I love finding something new and kind of coming into it blindly and just, you know, being enamored by the whole show. And this is it for me. This is honestly such an enjoyable watch, such an area of interest, beautifully made. I will be recommending this for months to come. So yeah, Blue Eye Samurai.
Very, very good then.
Shall I take us over to the news desk?
Please.
All right. So the first bit of news we've got is an unfortunate, sad passing of who most people probably know, Andre Brewer, as Captain Raymond Holt from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, has passed away at the age of 61, which is very sad. And he was a guy, it says after a brief illness, so that doesn't sound very good at all, but our thoughts out to his friends and family.
Horrible.
Indeed. There's an article that has just come out actually on IGN, and where Netflix has sort of revealed a report of its most watched shows for the first half of 2023. So bearing in mind that only takes us, I think, up until about, between January and June. But number one show, Paul, of viewing hours, The Night Agent, Season 1. 812 million hours of viewing.
Incredible. AKA Kind Eyes.
AKA Kind Eyes. So, wow, it's interesting there because I think, you know, I would love to know what the kind of breakdown is of, you know, do people kind of jump in at episode one and kind of peter off? But either way, that's the type of numbers that Half Measures gets. So it's incredible that a show like that can also match that standard. What else have we got here? So this is something for you, Paul. Bridgerton Season 3 will be returning next year, May 16th. They're going to have the first four episodes, and then nearly a month later, on the 13th of June, they'll have the final four episodes. So exciting times for the Bridgerton fans out there.
Queen Charlotte, the Bridgerton story was fantastic, but I have to admit it would be really good just to get into a regular Season 3 of Bridgerton. So yeah, looking forward to that.
We have got this, it's not really TV news, but it's linked. So Paddington, the musical, is going to be opening in the UK in 2025. If I happen to be in the UK, I'll be checking this out. I love a good marmalade sandwich and I love Paddington. So that is fun times. There is a new Marvel TV show called Eyes of Wakanda, which will be coming to Disney Plus soon, which is going to be sort of set in the Black Panther's world. So fans of that universe, you can expect some animation goodness coming your way very soon. We also have Saw 11. I can't believe we're up to number 11 of the Saw films. That has been confirmed now for a September 2024 release date. I think I've maybe only seen Saw 1. I'm well behind on those movies. And then, as I already mentioned, this is very hot off the press. Blue Eye Samurai has been renewed for Season 2. That is very exciting. Go and check out Season 1. That is me for news, Paul. Anything on your end?
Only a couple of things. There's three Dune movies, not two. So the director, Denis Villeneuve, has already got his sights on a third and final movie. So with Part 2, you know, coming soon, it looks like we're getting a third one. So that's quite exciting because I did really enjoy that first one. It'd be good to maybe do a watch of the week with you for the second. And the second thing which really caught my eye this week, and this showed up in our Discord news channel, is there's an Apple TV show on the horizon called Constellation. I mean, all of the things are ticks here. It looks fantastic. It's set in space. There's some sort of disaster going on. We've got Noomi Rapace, who is always great value. We've got Jonathan Banks, you and I were watching anything. It's just a number of, it's like a Liam Neeson with a black jacket and a gun and a stern face poster for me. I can't help myself. I'm going to watch it. So very excited about Constellation, which comes out 8 episodes in February next year. Dan, we haven't got time to mess about really, but I'm going to, because you said something and I can't help myself. You mentioned that you liked a marmalade sandwich. I tell you what, I love a marmalade sandwich. I love it on my toast and my bagel, whatever. I get a lot of grief at my workplace, my day job workplace. People at my work are not about marmalade at all. I'm interested specifically about what type of marmalade you're in. Are you in for, you know, the thick cut? Is it breakfast? Is it grapefruit? Is it orange? Is it lemon? What's your marmalade?
It's funny actually, because I don't eat a lot of marmalade, but it's the type of condiment that I might eat. Say if I'm in a, you know, like a some sort of like buffet breakfast, you're in a hotel or something and you've got all the mixtures of spreads, it's a great time to pull out marmalade, because it's just not something that's sort of a regular feature in my house. To be honest with you, I probably don't eat enough type of like toast or sandwiches, but I do like it as a bit of a, and I like the classic. I like the classic. Yeah, it's a great one. And I also won't hear anyone disparaging anything to do with Paddington. It's one of the greatest beers and TV shows and movies to exist.
Correct. I feel like if this podcast gig doesn't actually work out for us, we could also have a second career of podcasting around going from hotel to hotel and just criticizing the breakfast buffet, the layout of the room, you know, the service, the front desk, all of the things. I feel like that we'd have a lot of commentary about that.
Maybe that's just, we just critique everything. We're just critics. So we don't just stop it at movies and TV shows.
Measures hotels.
Yeah, exactly.
Mailbag, Dan. Couple of things in here. We actually had a couple of responses to the question which we were posed last week from Bruce Gray, which was, if you could choose a detective to solve your own murder, who would you pick? And so I wasn't expecting to hear as many of you did, so I just want to share them. We had Mike from Weston-super-Mare went with Inspector Keller, who was played, of course, by Michael Douglas for 4 seasons in the streets of San Francisco. And he also had Inspector Jack Frost, played by none other than Rodney Trotter's brother, Del Boy, a.k.a. David Jason, in A Touch of Frost. We had Mr. Fox from Cork say it has to be the irritating tramp in the trench coat, the one and only Columbo. That was my pick as well. Nicely done. We had Connie. I'm not sure where Connie's from. She follows us on Instagram. She went with DCI Stanhope, who, of course, is played by Kate Quinn in the British crime drama Vera, which reminds me I need to get back into season 3 of that. And we had Pat from Somerset. She went with Inspector Morse, played by John Thor in the 1990s series. So loved hearing some of those. Such a great question. I'll still stick with Columbo. Ian from Miami Beach, Florida, back in touch again, Dan. He says, after hearing your review of Bodies, I've just finished it. It was a really, really good watch. It made me think, did you guys watch 1899? I always hear you guys talking about subtitles, and this is a show you have to watch with subs, as there are multiple languages spoken, and the fact that the characters aren't multilingual means you can really start to get a feel for what it would really be like on the ship. It's a shame it only had 1 season. It felt like they rushed the end a bit, but I really liked it. So if you haven't, do watch it. Now, Dan, I know that we had this one discussed in our Discord by other listeners, but we've never watched it. And yet I feel like this was on your radar at one point, 1899.
Well, it was, because obviously, you know, you and I watched Dark, and it's the same creators, producers. But I kind of opted out when they cancelled it after the first season. I don't know. As soon as I find out they've cancelled a show, and if they're not going to give me enough conclusion, I find it hard to go into a show like that. But I have heard some quite positive things, despite my weird hang-ups.
Yeah. Thanks for getting in touch again, Ian. It does remain on my list, but the list is spiralling out of control. Finally, Dan, last week's peak performance was director M. Night Shyamalan.
It's the Kroninsky of names, isn't it?
It is.
M. Night Shyamalan.
Thank you, Shyamalan. Ryan from Oakland. Welcome back, Ryan. We have not had you in the mailbag for a couple of months. He went with Knock at the Cabin. Samara from Taranaki went honourable mention of Split. Peak performance was The Village. Great choice. Diana from Capity Coast went with the Joaquin Phoenix Mel Gibson film Signs. Another great pick. Michael from North Carolina gave us his picks, an honourable mention of The Visit, and then a 3-2-1 of Split, Unbreakable, and peak performance Sixth Sense. I think, in keeping with our football theme this week, it's probably a yellow card that should be brandished for attempting to get 4 picks in there somehow, but nicely done. And finally, Paddy from Time Traveling Team Podcast, 3-2-1 of Unbreakable, Sixth Sense, and Knock at the Cabin. And he also came to the party for Vin Diesel, which he missed last week, The Chronicle of Riddick, Boiler Room, and Saving Private Ryan. That's the mailbag, Dan.
Those are very good choices, and it's great to know that Paddy is still alive and kicking after missing an episode of Half Measures for the first time in a very long time.
Correct.
Paul, it must be time for our final peak performance of the year, and we've got a special request this time for peak performance. So I'm just going to read this out because I'll probably get it wrong. So this is a special request from Tony, who wrote in and said, for an Xmas special podcast, let's hear your top 5 Christmas movies with a peak performance twist, Sensational Santa. So we're looking for here, what are your top 5 Christmas movies, and who's your top pick for playing Santa in a movie, Paul?
This question, I appreciate the question, Tony. This question has taught me one thing, and that is I haven't watched as many Christmas movies as I thought I had, or more to the point, I haven't enjoyed as many Christmas movies as I thought maybe I had. Maybe I'm a Grinch. That certainly checks out. I do have five for you, Dan, and I'll give you them from five down to number one. And I did check in with you ahead of time as to what constituted a Christmas movie, and you were quite flexible on the rules, and I appreciate that. Number five is the 1947 classic, Miracle on 34th Street. You can't get past that. Number four, I had to get it in there somewhere, Love Actually. It's a real classic. I feel like we'll need to get that out at some point over Christmas. Number three, also a classic because it's just become a meme, is Die Hard. It's just become synonymous with Christmas. And then my last two are genuinely back on the Christmas track. Number two, The Christmas Chronicles. Underrated movie. I really enjoy it. But my number one, and this is by quite a long shot for me, that is 1985's Santa Claus, the movie. Those are my top five. I'll come back to my peak performance Santas. I've got an honourable mention and I've got a peak Santa. What are your five Christmas movies, Dan?
Oh, I haven't thought about an honourable mention for my Santa, but yeah, this was an interesting one. I kind of found myself going a little bit off the grid from the classic Santa movie. So number five for me, 1990s Home Alone. You can't beat little Kevin, Macaulay Culkin, being left alone at Christmas. Number four, the Will Ferrell classic Elf stands out as, you know, one that's a great watch every year. Number three for me, a bit like you, Die Hard 1988. I know people like to debate, is this a Christmas movie? Is it not? It is set on Christmas Eve. What type of evil workplace has a party on Christmas Eve?
Correct.
Like they deserve to have. Like, I just couldn't think of anything worse. Number two, The Nightmare Before Christmas. Absolutely love this movie. It's a classic Tim Burton.
That is a good pick, Dan.
I love the sort of the segue between Halloween and Christmas. And my actual peak performance goes to a movie I've talked about here on a few times on the pod. I always encourage people to watch this. Bad Santa from 2003, starring Billy Bob Thornton. This is a classic scumbag Christmas. Highly recommended. Once the kids have gone to bed, check this one out. It's a good laugh.
That's a good five, Dan. I feel like if I could steal one from yours, I feel disappointed in myself that I haven't got Home Alone in there, because you're right, that does feel like a real Christmas watch. So a good five there. From that, pulling out of a peak performance Santa, my honourable mention goes to Kurt Russell in The Christmas Chronicles. I feel like he delivers a really satisfying Santa. I feel like, I don't know how much is real beard and how much is not, because we've seen Kurt Russell's beard in a number of movies where it's exceptional, but he does a really good Santa Claus. But my winner, again, in line with my number one movie, Santa Claus the movie. I remember going to see this at the cinema in London, which for me was a big deal, you know, in the UK. I think I've only watched two movies in London in my entire time there. So back in 1985, to go to the cinema to see this was brilliant. So when I think of Father Christmas, when I think of Santa Claus, this is the guy, David Huddleston, who I think of, who played Santa Claus in that movie. And I also think of him from, you know, The Big Lebowski and other movies, but he as Santa was just fantastic. So yeah, Kurt Russell and David Huddleston. What about you?
I don't think I have an honourable mention. Well, if I was going to just sort of pick one quickly, who would I go for? Maybe Edward Asner would be my honourable mention. He played Santa in the Elf movie. Classic actor. But I'm actually going to go with my number one movie of Billy Bob Thornton. His Santa in Bad Santa is so good. He's a thief. He's an alcoholic. He's a real deadbeat. It's top quality Christmas fun for me every year.
That's what Christmas is all about. And on that note, that's our peak performance for 2023 wrapped up.
Indeed it is. So yeah, next week we'll be back with won't be back, it's the week off, but we'll be getting ready with our top 10 TV shows of 2023. Last year, highly controversial, I brought a TV show in that started airing at the end of end of the year. I tried to bring it in for 2022, haven't lived it down. I'm going to be a bit harder on myself this year and try to lock it down. We do need to have a rules committee meeting to work out what is the criteria for bringing shows to the table this year. Will there be any honourable mentions? Are we just going straight into top 10? What's going to look like? Don't know. We'll work that out off here. But make sure you check back in. Paul, I guess that does bring us to the end of another episode of the Half Measures podcast.
It does indeed. I think just in line with what we said about the morning show, what happens off air, you know, we present this united front. I think it's worth a peek behind the curtain for listeners to know that controversial 1883 that you tried to bring in to, you know, the Yellowstone series that you tried to bring in, was nearly the end of this podcast. I mean, we didn't talk for a long time after that, and it took Patreon producers to bring us back together. We obviously made it, but we do need to be clear in our rules this time. And I think the rule was, if one episode of the show aired in 2023, that's good enough. So by those rules, you were quite okay to have your show in there.
Right, okay. And should we just work out while we're on here right now, are we going to have any honourable mentions, or are we... Like last year, we had, I think we had two honourables.
I need them. I need the two. I need the two for each pod, because that means I can have, you know, 10 and plus two and two, which gives me 14.
So that's the rule. That's the rule. Okay. All right. I will let my team know that is what they need to start thinking about as they start to collate the numbers. I'll be looking across all the various platforms. I'll be consulting review aggregators, whatever the word is, and I'm looking forward to it.
It's my favorite time of the year, this podcast, so I'm looking forward to it too.
Indeed. Well, that looks like it is the end for us, Paul.
It does indeed. If you have a movie or TV show suggestion for us to watch over the Christmas period, do get in touch with us, halfmeasurespodcast.com or on our social media, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Also, a very special shout out to our Patreon producers, Samara Whiting King, Dinah Kanawa, Trisha Brady, and Michael Chalmers. I do hope that you have a safe and happy holidays, and please make sure you give the gift that keeps giving. A review or a star rating for our podcast would be very much appreciated. But until next week, everyone, adios.